Okay.
Where in that and where he comes to me? Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
I'll get my chair and I'll tell you that stuff in with you.
Okay.
Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 18th, 2015. Let the record show the quorum. We have seven bills on the agenda that we'd like to get through today, so we're going to get started right away with Senator Eakin, Senate File 1267. Senator Eakin, welcome to the committee.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1267 is a bill dealing with border city housing construction. It's a bill that's designed to level the playing field between the border cities and our neighbors to the west. I represent the city of Moorhead, and we have, of course, the powerhouse, North Dakota powerhouse of Fargo, right across the river. And in order to be competitive for residential new home construction, the city of Moorhead and border cities are seeking a mechanism to fairly compete with cities in their neighboring states. And this would require modification of the Minnesota Building Code so that cities in these situations, like Moorhead, would be no less restrictive than their adjacent North Dakota jurisdictions for the construction of single and two-family dwellings and townhomes only. Again, they would be no less restrictive than what the neighboring jurisdiction in North Dakota is. And I think that it's important to note that Moorhead is one market with Fargo and West Fargo, North Dakota. Uniformity in the marketplace is absolutely key to the ability to compete. Competitiveness, the differences between the two states' building codes does affect Moorhead's growth. Minnesota's higher construction standards are not what's at dispute here. It's the fact that it's creating the unlevel playing field. And a border city home buyer, many of them will choose Fargo simply for that reason. And I think it's also important to note that when you have such codes in place in a border city like Moorhead, right next to Fargo, it doesn't take much to push people to locate in Fargo instead, where you have the lower restrictions. And so what ends up happening is you're not achieving the goals that the codes had set up. You're just simply causing the people to move to the other side of the river where they don't have these stricter codes. So the issue isn't whether people are building up to these higher codes. It's a matter of where they're building. So I think that needs to be a major factor in the decision here on this bill today. I do have two who are going to testify to the bill with me today, Scott Hutchins, the city manager of Moorhead, and Clay Dietrich, who is the head of the Home Builders Association for Fargo-Moorhead and also the assistant fire chief. So with that, I think we'll start off with Mr. Hutchins.
Mr. Hutchins, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. Scott Hutchins, deputy city manager, city of Moorhead. Senator Eakin has outlined the salient points of this proposed legislation. I'd just like to reiterate a couple of those. One is the production, and you have in your packet some information that provides materials on, or provides the data on the number of homes in this category of single, two-family, and townhomes being constructed in these border communities, particularly East Grand Forks and Grand Forks, Moorhead, Fargo, and West Fargo. And you can see that the differentials are very, very significant. And as Senator Eakin noted, this is an opportunity maybe to get some more of this business back in Moorhead and in Minnesota. And while we appreciate uniformity across the state, our market, as is noted, is really West Fargo and Fargo. East Grand Forks is looking to Grand Forks. That is the marketplace that our builders and consumers are operating in, and that's the area that is most important to us and where we would like to have an opportunity to be just a bit more competitive in one of the most important industries in our area, which is residential construction. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Dietrich?
Thank you, Senators and Chairman, for allowing me to speak today. A little bit of a history on me. I'm a home builder from the Moorhead area. I've been in the home building business since I was 15, so a while. I was also an assistant fire chief for Moorhead for 27 years. And I'm currently the president of the Home Builders Association of Fargo Moorhead. And that association represents all the builders in our metro area, which includes Fargo, West Fargo, Moorhead, Dilworth, and some of the smaller surrounding communities. And part of our organization's goals are to meet with all the different codes officials throughout our service area and work on their new codes whenever they come up. And so we currently have a process where we meet with Fargo and West Fargo's building codes officials, and we go over the code and discuss what's new and what's going to work for our area and what isn't. And Fargo and West Fargo have the ability through Home Rule Charter to adapt what parts of the uniform building codes that they want and change things to meet their market. Moorhead and Dilworth and Minnesota communities do not have that advantage because of the state-mandated building code. They're not able to adapt or meet what is happening in Fargo and West Fargo. So consequently, what happens is the North Dakota side has an advantage from a code standpoint, and it ends up being an issue where the cities and municipalities don't really get their fair share of the housing market because of that. We keep track of permit reports, and the information that was given to you by Scott Hutchins is accurate. We actually do a monthly report on all permits written in the area. And Moorhead, although it has some of the nicest lots and the best areas to build, it's a very small portion of the new home construction because of some of the code issues and the increased cost to build in those areas.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I heard the testifiers, if I understood correctly, that the uniform building code, that the border cities, some can opt out of that because of their charter status.
Correct.
What I'd like to know then, what are they opting out of? What are those things that are making your single-family and two-family dwellings and townhouses uncompetitive? What parts of that uniform building code are your Minnesota cities not able to opt out of that are making, that are the impetus for the bill before us today?
Mr. Dietrich. Go ahead.
The main thing that's happening with the one that just got adapted by Minnesota, and it's changed throughout the years because there's always been some differences. Probably one of the bigger ones right now is the energy code. And what Fargo did is they kept the 2009 energy code, which Minnesota actually jumped over. They had their code was actually from 2006, and they had increased the 2006 energy code actually almost what the 2009 was. So when Fargo, they were ahead of Fargo for about 3 years, and when Fargo took the 2009, that playing field got pretty even. But now with the new energy code, that's going to be what we're seeing in our estimates is about $7,000 to $11,000 per home added cost. And the worst part about it is the payback is 44 years without interest or consideration that the equipment that you're buying is going to fail and need replacement before that. So there never is a payback. So it's an expense that they'll put on their homes. They'll have a hard time getting it appraised because the appraisal goes for the entire market, not just Moorhead.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a hardship there. Part of the new code also is the sprinkler for over 4,500 square feet in houses. And for twin homes, Fargo's sprinkler starts at threeplexes and ups. And they did that actually by state law there. So that's another portion. And those two items are the two big ones that we have right now. There's some other little nuances, but that's the big ticket items there.
So, Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. So the fact that Fargo has been able to not adopt the uniform energy code that Minnesota has allowed or has made your city's building These new construction homes cost $7,000 to $11,000 more per home because you have to abide by the Minnesota has adopted, the Uniform Building Code, which includes these energy codes that have this high price tag that doesn't have a payback for 44 years, and because of the sprinkler mandate. Are those the two big ones?
Yeah, and the sprinkler mandate is outside of that $7,000 to $11,000 number. That would be an additional minimum of $9,000 to $14,000 added on top of that again. So the $7,000 to $11,000 was just the energy code number. That $9,000 to $14,000 is the sprinkler code number.
Senator Nelson, page 2 of the handout has a lot of that information as Great. Well. Senator Dames?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Eakin. Just a couple of things. The first question I have is, can you tell me how many miles you have to be away from the border to be considered a border city? I have a community that's within about 8 miles of the border, but there's no other communities in between it. Would that be a border community?
Mr. Hutchins or Mr. Dietrich? Senator Eakin, I'm sorry.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, and I've been told that it's contiguous, so that if it's a city that's contiguous with another one. And it would include Morehead and Dilworth would both be included because Dilworth is contiguous with Morehead.
Sir Dames.
And then to follow that up, first of all, I'm going to make it very plain. I'm going to vote for the bill because I don't feel that we should penalize people in Morehead, Minnesota, because of the rules and regulations we have in Minnesota. But when I hear you say, Senator Kent, that this isn't an attack on Minnesota building codes, you know, if we didn't have these building codes that are so aggressive and probably so outreaching, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation today. And if this is good for Morehead, Minnesota, it's probably good for Marshall, Minnesota, probably good for Mankato, Minnesota, probably good for a lot of communities. And so I guess I find it interesting, and like I said, I'm going to support the bill because I don't think we ought to penalize our border cities. But I find it kind of interesting that we pass rules around here, we come up with these codes, and then we realize what impact it's having, so we come around and we make these little exceptions. Why don't we just clean our codes up so that we can compete in Minnesota? So to hear you say this is not an attack on building codes, I appreciate the way you're approaching this, but maybe we do need to attack Minnesota's codes. When we start taking a look and hearing somebody say that the energy portion would cost $7,000 to $11,000 more per home, the fire code provisions will cost $9,000 to $14,000 more per home. That's anywhere from $16,000 to $25,000 more per home to build a home in Minnesota, in Moorhead, Minnesota versus Fargo. And that's just unjustifiable. We really, and this isn't anything against you, Senator Eakin. I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. But I think we all should be seeing what's happening here, and we should be listening, and we should be saying, you know, we need to do something about this. We need to make sure that we can be competitive in Minnesota, and we're not choosing to do that. Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Senator Rood, then Senator Nelson. Senator Rood.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dames, I couldn't agree with you more. And Senator Eakin, I can tell you that if you find out how to carve out Morehead, Minnesota out of the sprinkler issue, I can tell you that on the floor of the Senate, I will have a bill that has every single one of my communities and counties to attach to your bill, because we would all love this provision and to be applicable to all of our communities, because it's something, it's an issue that affects all of Minnesota. And you're right, in greater Minnesota, that sprinkler is going to cost probably a minimum of $10,000 per home on up. And so if you are able to get this to the floor of the Senate, God bless you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator
Rood, thank you, Mr. Chair.
God bless you as well.
I'm with you.
Senators Rood and Dames, I do not take issue with your comments. I think you make some compelling points. I just wanted to make it clear that, that what we're dealing with here, it's kind of a separate issue. We're talking about the unique situation that's being faced by the border cities, and it's not just Morehead. I mentioned Dilworth as well and the other border cities that are included, and it's a very unique situation given the fact that there's this big oil boom that's taking place in North Dakota. Has created a very unlevel playing field. So that added on top of the code differentials results in some very difficult, challenging situations for the border cities that other cities don't face.
Sarah Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for council, and then I have an amendment. And my question is, can in the state of Minnesota, can charter rule cities exempt themselves, as has Fargo, from the Uniform Building Code? And if we can't, why can Fargo do it and we can't in Minnesota? Or Morehead.
Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson. I didn't quite understand your question. Obviously, Fargo operates under a different set of laws
right.
than does Morehead. So whatever Fargo does is pursuant to North Dakota
law.
Well,
let me rephrase my question.
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair. My question is, can charter rule cities in Minnesota opt out of parts of the Uniform Building Code?
Mr. Fuller?
I can give you a partial answer, and I'll check the statute. I know that those municipalities that were under the code as of a certain time have no ability to opt back out. What's not clear to me is whether they can opt out if they weren't in. And I'll check the statute and get back to you in a minute.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And, Mr. Chair,
is
this the time to offer an amendment?
Why don't we, if it's okay with you, we did want to hear from Mr. McClellan from the Department of Labor and Industry, and then
okay.
Can we come back to you and maybe Mr. Fuller will have an answer to your question at that time?
Yes.
Okay.
And I could give him an amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Nelson.
Well, he's coming up, Mr. Chair. I just got a quick comment.
Sir Dave.
Senator Eakin referred to the advantage that North Dakota has because of their oil. You know, we could have the same advantage here if we would put Minnesota in the same position. If we want to do that, we can. We can put our other states around us at the same in competitive position. It's called mining. We have the opportunity to do that with our mining in northern Minnesota. So if we want to be in that same position, we just need to move forward on that, and then we can put our the states around us, put them at a disadvantage.
Okay. Mr. McClellan, if you'd like to come forward at this time for some brief comments. And maybe if you heard Senator Nelson's question, maybe you would have some insight into that too, Mr. McClellan. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator, and committee members. Good afternoon. My name is Scott McClellan. I'm the director of the Construction Codes and Licensing Division. I can give some just brief comments and then respond to any of your questions if you care to lay.
Perfect.
In 1972, when the state building code was established, at that time there were many different codes throughout the state. And due to that confusion, due to the expenses involved, incurred in trying to achieve compliance and determine what compliance was in any different municipality, the legislature established that there should be a single code in the state to try to bring this all together and try to do away with the unpredictability of how to design, how to build in any different jurisdiction. Since that time, there's always been pressure from stakeholders, be it manufacturers of products, be it individual builders, contractors, owners, manufacturers, to try to depart from that and to try to pull favor the code to their side, which we understand. So it's a constant battle. Although the department is, in fact, sympathetic to the city of Morehead's challenges with their neighbors at Fargo, the department believes that the building code in Minnesota best protects the consumer's safety in the code that we have, as well as their financial interest in guarding the largest purchase they'll likely ever make. We believe that the construction community, including contractors, builders, architects, and building officials, prefer to have more predictable government understand what the code is in any given jurisdiction. I have other comments I could make, Mr. Chair, but I'd be happy to address any questions you have.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Any questions for the testifier? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you answer the question? You may have, and I might have just gotten the last part of it. But so in Minnesota, can a charter rule city opt out of pieces of the Uniform Building Code as they can in South Dakota or North Dakota or anywhere else?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I can't answer that assuredly. I don't actually know if that's the case or not. I'm not aware of an exception, Senator.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
I just find it interesting that that cities in other states, charter rule cities in other states, are able to opt out of building codes that supposedly uniform building codes that Minnesota cities cannot. And they're not insignificant. Here we're talking $25,000 perhaps. So they're not, it's not an insignificant question. I think it's something we need to know. What is it? Is it something in state statute that allows other cities in other states to opt out of costly provisions in the Uniform Building Code? You know, what is it that's preventing Minnesota cities from being able to do that?
Mr. McClellan?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson. I can't speak to what other states have done, Senator. I just know that in Minnesota, once you've adopted the code in a jurisdiction, you're bound by the entire code, and there are not options to opt out of the code, although that's always a tension, especially when something impacts them greatly.
So they must not be uniform. It must not be federal. It must be state-derived that prevents us from having the same flexibility that Fargo does. So it must be something derived at the state of Minnesota level that is preventing cities from having the same flexibility that our neighbors to the west do.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, yes, that is correct. In Minnesota, that's been established by the legislature as to the terms of who the building code applies to. And so that's a legislative decision that was made back in 1972.
Right. Senator Rood.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, maybe I can give a little clarification. Cities have the opportunity to opt into the building code. They are not automatically to abide by it. Like in the city of Breezy Point, we had many hearings in our city to decide if we would adopt the building code or not adopt it. And so, like, the city of Breezy Point has it. They decided to adopt it. Nisswa did not. Cross Lake did not. Pequot did not. We're kind of an island unto ourselves. But we had the opportunity to adopt it. Once we did adopt it, then we are bound by its rules and all of its rules. We can't opt out of piecemeal. And that's why the cities have, you know, usually rigorous hearings to decide if that's the direction they want to go or not. And so once you're not bound by it until you adopt it. But once you do, you've made that decision to adopt the whole code. But the sprinkler ban is not a state. That is the Universal Building Code. So that's a different code.
Oh, but I am talking about the Universal Building Code. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
I am asking
about the Universal Building Code.
Senator Eakin?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, in North Dakota, the state law does give charter cities the flexibility on some of these rules, whereas we don't see that kind of latitude or flexibility allowed here in Minnesota. And another issue on the fire sprinkler issue, the state of North Dakota itself does not allow any jurisdiction to implement the fire sprinkler requirement in North Dakota. So Fargo can't even do that if they wanted to, which means that will always be a factor in the differential between Minnesota and Minnesota.
Okay. Senator Weber, then we've got to move towards a vote.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McClellan, as the Uniform Building Codes are put together, is there ever any consideration given on the part of, as they're drawing them, on the part of what we see in adjoining communities, like, for example, across the state line into Fargo, or in Sioux Falls in my area, or across the line into Wisconsin on the east side of the state here?
Mr. Chair, Senator, when we evaluate a new model code for adoption, it's not paramount in our mind what neighboring states are doing, but we are aware that Wisconsin is under International Residential Code the same year that we are. There are few states that actually have a statewide code. Wisconsin is one of them. South Dakota, it's left up to the individual cities. Iowa, it's up to the individual cities. So every state does things a little bit different. But we don't want to be the only ones out there doing the latest and greatest if it hasn't been generally incorporated somewhere else in the state. In fact, our statute says we're to adopt codes that are generally in use throughout the United States. So.
Mr. Chair, Senator one Weber. Quick follow-up. Mr. McClellan, I'm not too sure that Minnesota has the reputation of not always being out there trying to do the latest and greatest, quite frankly. But I do think, as being in a, I consider my community being 12 miles from the state line as a border community, and I already fight plenty of battles, whether it's with tax policy, whether it's with business, general business climate issues. Quite frankly, every element we pile on in terms of a competitive disadvantage is magnified, no matter where you are in the state of Minnesota as relates to our bordering communities. And if those issues are not in kept in mind when building codes are talked about and considered for change, I think that well should be.
Mm-hmm. Understood.
Thank you very much. Okay, Ms. Stone, if you'd like to add something briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Remy Stone with the Builders Association of Minnesota. If you asked me if I supported this bill or opposed this bill, I would have to say yes. But what I wanted to add to the record is, regardless of whether a municipality chooses to enforce the state building code, a licensed builder needs to build to the adopted code of the state. So you can be in one of those communities that has not opted into enforcement, but we still have a professional and licensing obligation to build to whatever code the state has adopted statewide. And that's all I had to add, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you shed some light on – oh, no, could you ask Ms. Stone, is it? Could you shed some light on the comments that Senator Rood made with regard to the universal building code and where that sprinkler mandate actually came from?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it's the International Construction Codes, which is a model code adopted internationally. It's pretty much Canada and the United States. That's where the sprinkler provision was tucked in 2008. When Minnesota adopted the 2012 code that we now call the 2015 Minnesota Residential Code, that is where we now have the sprinkler mandate provision. So it's in the Minnesota Residential Code.
Sir Bonoff, but just let's just kind of stick to the bill, though, too. We're getting a little sideways here, but
okay.
Go ahead and make your point.
Never mind, Mr. Chair.
We would like that broader amendment, Mr. Chair, that was being discussed.
You may get your opportunity. Senator Nelson.
Are you ready for an amendment, Mr.
Sure.
Chair? All right. I have an oral amendment on page 3, line 4. Delete the following words. Authorized to establish a border city enterprise zone as defined, and then strike in line 3.5 the words in section 469.166. And then go down to line 3.7 and put a period after state building code, period, and delete the rest of paragraph H. So the amended language would read, a municipality may by ordinance adopt building code provisions related to detached one- and two-family dwellings and townhomes that are different from provisions of the state building code. And so what that would do, Mr. Chair and committee members, is it would grant the same flexibility to every Minnesota city and town as Senator Eaton, you are requesting. And why would I do that? And that is because we are ever more a global community. People live wherever they would like, and they do their work via the internet or other things. We are no longer as tightly confined to live where we work. There is great flexibility. And so I actually like your bill, Senator Eakin, and I like it so much that I would like every city and town, every municipality to have the same provisions that your bill seeks.
Okay. Senator Eakin, and then I think Mr. Fuller, but go ahead, Senator Eakin, if you'd like to respond.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, and I don't take issue with your amendment and the arguments you make for your amendment, but this is a bill that's dealing with a unique situation. What you're referring to is a much larger issue. We're talking about the unique situation that we're facing in the border cities. And so I would oppose the amendment for that reason. Not saying that I oppose the ideas that you're putting forth here, but I do think that we need to just deal with the uniqueness of the situation that we're facing on the borders. It is quite unique when you're directly adjacent to a powerhouse like Fargo on the North Dakota side. It doesn't take much to push construction and homeowners to the other side of the river. It is different if you're located further in inside the state from those locations.
Okay. Sarah Nelson.
I was hoping Senator Eakin would look at this as a friendly amendment because it actually does exactly what you want your bill to do, only for the rest of the state. But I do think it's highly significant. And this $25,000 figure of increased cost at a time when we in this body are talking about affordable housing, I just cannot quite grapple with that. And so I'll ask for a roll call on this amendment.
Okay. Mr. Fuller?
Mr. Chair, just some points of information. What Ms. Stone said about it being the standard. So if you look at back a couple years ago, we passed a law that said this is the standard for which if you get sued, you have to build to this. And so that standard will still exist. So we'd have a situation where somebody could comply with a municipal code and be sued, perhaps. I mean, that's at least a high potential. I don't know if it's a fact. Okay. Second point of information, I was looking for everything. It's in the bill. All the other provisions that relate to the application of the state building code. If you look at paragraph C, it says a municipality must not by ordinance or blah, 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 adopt it that are different than the state building code. So we have, you know, so what the bill is an exception to that general proposition. Now the amendment would make that the general proposition, so we'd have to deal with other provisions in the statute. Mr. Knopf pointed out one to me which says state building code supersedes all local building codes. And so it's an issue that requires some attention to exactly what's happening. That's
the Sarah Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Ford, for that good counsel. But the amendment that I have before this body doesn't change anything. That whatever would happen under Senator Eakin's bill would also be the very same issues that we would need to address with the amendment that I've provided. So the amendment that I have doesn't add any new issue. It simply adds more cities and more towns. It would not change the issues at all or the concerns that you mentioned. It would just offer other cities an opportunity for the same flexibility.
Okay, a roll call has been requested on the Sarah Nelson oral amendment. This is a pretty major provision to be bringing forward the last day of before deadline, but that's fine. So the clerk will take the roll.
Senator Sparks?
No.
Senator Bonoff?
No.
Senator Dames?
Yes.
Senator Eakin?
No.
Senator Herr?
No.
Senator Coonan?
No.
Senator Nelson?
Yes.
Senator Rest?
No.
Senator Rood?
No.
Senator Schmidt?
No.
Senator Weber?
Yes.
On a vote of 8, there being 3 ayes and 8 noes, the oral amendment is not adopted. Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question for counsel. So with your comment a little earlier about the liability, if that amendment was changed, the amendment didn't pass, so is Moorhead still going to have that same liability you referred to? And if not, why not? Not that I'm encouraging they should, but I just want to have clarity here that if it was going to be there with the amendment, how are we going to get around it without now that the amendment isn't passed?
Mr. Fuller?
Mr. Chair, that is an issue. Subdivision 1 of the same section that we're looking at, 121, says that the state building code is the standard that applies statewide for the construction, reconstruction, alteration, repair, and use of buildings and other structures of the type governed by the code. Very confusing. Confused me when we passed it. The code doesn't apply statewide. but the standards do. So, yes, the answer to your question is yes.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ames.
Senator Eakin, is this where you want to put the city of Moorhead? You want to put him in that precarious position?
Senator Eakin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, I think that we would have to work on this language as we move forward to address that issue. Not the intent to put them in a situation where there could be lawsuits coming, but I think there's a way to accomplish this without inviting that type of action. So that's something that I think we do need to work on as we move forward here.
Thank you. Okay. Sir, can you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I would move that Senate File 1267 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor.
Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion
no.
The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Cohen, thank you for your patience. Senate File 803.
Scott.
And hopefully, if we could see, we have eight more bills to go. So if we can try to keep this somewhat brief, that would be helpful, Senator Cohen.
I'll do my very best. Thank you for having me. Senate File 803 is a bill that was brought to my attention by a number of folks in my district. And, in fact, members might recall that we had a lengthy conversation about this bill last year on the Senate floor. Mr. Bickey is going to offer a couple minutes of testimony, but let me just kind of set the stage. And I understand you've been working on issues relative to code compliance. X number of years ago, it was determined that elevators within multi-story residential units would have to be brought up to a higher level of code, and obviously for safety purposes. And certainly on the surface, that's a laudable goal. This is an issue that probably, I know my conversations with folks at both the city of St. Paul level and to a lesser extent the state, I think this is an issue that tends to be probably a little bit more of a metropolitan issue to the extent that you don't have larger buildings, as many larger buildings in our state. That might be probably the community of Rochester might be an exception to that, for instance, as a larger population center. But in this particular instance, the issue that was brought to my attention by this group of constituents was the fact that this was a building that was entirely owner-occupied, and occupied, I believe, a three-story building, occupied by folks, many of whom are retired, all of whom have worked all their lives, thought that once upon retirement they'd be able to be in a position to enjoy limited incomes. Nobody in the building is wealthy, and when this code change was passed, requiring the change in elevator status, it was going to put an extremely onerous burden on every single person within the building. I've had a couple of meetings with the entirety of the residents of the building, but probably pretty close to that, and listening to the stories of whether or not they could come up with the $20,000, the $30,000, the $40,000 on an individual basis to bring this building up to code compliance. This is a smaller building. It's a building with a limited number of units and with an elevator that was in working order. So I actually had an amendment last year to, in fact, Senator Coonan is going to remember this quite clearly because it was his bill, and the senator, before the bill came up on the floor, indicated that he would allow my, would be supportive of my amendment, which he graciously did, and we got into the further elevator discussion, which took actually much longer than my simple little amendment. And so what I thought I would do this year is rather than do this through amendment on the floor, to prepare a simple bill, and it's very straightforward. It just indicates that if the elevator was installed prior to the January 2007 date, where you have a residential unit with, as defined, common interest ownership with five or fewer floors. It's exempt from the elevator requirement. And, Mr. Chairman, I understand you're putting together an omnibus bill and would hope that it might be included in that bill and not necessarily passed to the floor. But I did want Mr. Fricke to have the opportunity to offer some testimony as to what the residents have gone through with the ups and downs of this in a situation. And maybe I can just offer just kind of an anecdotal basis. For a couple of years, I lived in an apartment complex in my district called Montcalm Estates. And it's a three-building it's got three separate buildings with, I think, 35 units a building, very nice apartments, with ownership by a significant property owner in the Twin Cities. And so when that building came up for compliance, I think they increased rents by $20 a month or something. I forget what they did. But it was a fairly simple issue, and in that particular building you have a range of income levels. So it's a little bit different when you have a building which has a smaller number of units with, and it's all owner-occupied, where individuals simply can't afford this on fixed incomes. That's the purpose of this issue. And, Mr. Chairman, if you'd allow Mr. Fricke to testify for a couple of minutes, I'd very much appreciate that.
You're bet. Mr. Fricke, welcome to the committee.
Yes. Thank you, Chairman Sparks and committee members. I'm Len Fricke, president of the 200 River Drive Condominium Association, where I've been a homeowner for 39 years. As Mr. Senator Cohen stated, we wouldn't be here if the 2007 code change had not been made retroactive. That's our beef, is the retroactive part in the corresponding hardship that causes our owners. But it's also the measure was implemented without proper cost-benefit analysis in contravention of most government rules regarding retroactive code changes. We have supporting documentation. I'm not going to read all that for you. It's in your package, but I would be happy to. I'd actually be happy to actually cite directly out of the department's own statement of need and reasonableness, where they have said one thing and done another. But that probably is best left for your questioning. How would each of you feel if some agency was forcing you to spend over 13% of your home's property value to protect from something that has never happened in Minnesota? Nationally, the probability of dying in an elevator as a result of a fire in a low-rise building is less than the chance of dying while out walking your dog. Life is full of risk, but good government has to take at least into account the risk probability and the cost effectiveness of any mandated measures to eliminate that risk. This hadn't been done. The legislature allows motorcyclists the option of not wearing helmets. So surely it should let homeowners make similar decisions in cases where the probability of dying is ridiculously small. Contrary to what most of the elevator code people think, we're not scofflaws or people who need to be protected by government. Our 19-unit association includes a retired elementary teacher, librarian, a retired university PhD in biology, an international educator, a retired director of social services at the former Cambridge State Hospital, a pastor's widow, two nurses, a widowed editor, two civil engineers, a member of the Metropolitan Council's staff, a realtor, a retired CPA, a retired social worker, and a retired state employee who has a master's degree from the Humphrey Institute. I'm going to diverge a bit in anticipation of Mr. McClellan's opposition comments to say one of the things that comes up is the fact that we did sign a two-year extension request in order to obtain an extension. We had to agree to comply by the beginning of this year. But I did so because I had a gun to my head. At the time, I had been denied financing in the summer of 2012 by the two largest banks in Minnesota. For the sole reason that my property had declined in value by almost 45%. We haven't recovered from the Great Recession yet. This is ridiculous. Homeowners don't have the ability to finance, no matter how much time they're given, if the cost of compliance is more than their mortgages. I mean, if their mortgages are greater than their home's value. We live in a concrete, stone, and steel building. We have separate concrete stairwells. We have the average size is less than 877 square feet. Our building is not a palace for the rich and famous. In the last 17 years, the 19 homeowners have voted to invest $725,000 to maintain the physical integrity of our 50-year-old building. The expense per owner ranged from $26,000 to $79,000. We're responsible homeowners. I brought up my children in this building, so of course we care about safety. Our elevator is safe. It's been serviced quarterly for 40 years. 14 months ago, Senator Cohen asked the department for some very simple questions. The department has not provided any direct answers to those questions or statistics that would satisfy a high school science teacher, much less any sound businessman. More on that is in our information package. Because of the different unit size, the cost of compliance ranges from $7,200 per owner to $22,000. If I don't know what the senator's house is valued at because he's moved, but he's still in the district. But Erin Murphy, our representative home, if she had to pay 13%, it'd be over $50,000. You know, that's not good government. That's foolishness. In 2013, I talked to the owner of a management company, and they had a Twin Cities condominium, and they had opposed this legislation when it, or the, these rules when they first came up in 2007. But he still had a condominium that faced the compliance issue. He called me back later that summer and said, gee, we just learned that somehow we've been exempted. So our understanding is throughout the state of Minnesota, exemptions have been granted for all sorts of low-rise buildings, probably every municipal building, probably most churches, probably every nursing home. And I think that was exemption was somehow tied to the length of the elevator run. That exemptions are fine, but they should logically, since this is a fire code, be tied to fire code standards. And the standard that is most logical differentiation between a high rise and a low rise is standpipes. If you don't need standpipes,
Mr. Fricke, can I ask you to kind of wrap up?
That's okay. It. Thank
Perfect.
You
Thank you.
Time.
You've done a lot of research, and we appreciate it. You have a champion author and Senator Cohn. So I think Mr. McClellan would like to respond a little bit to some of your testimony, and then we'll ask Senator Cohn what he'd like to do with this bill. So, Mr. McClellan, if you'd like to come forward. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Fricke.
Good afternoon again, committee members. Senator Sparks, Scott McClellan, Director of the Construction Codes and Licensing Division. Generally, building construction codes are not retroactive. The exception to that are very limited, and only in those cases where safety is paramount and any sort of a failure could be considered catastrophic, such as with an elevator. So the National Elevator Codes, not Minnesota's code, has for years required that existing elevators undergo a periodic inspection to make sure that they are safe and serviceable. It wasn't actually until 2007 that Minnesota finally decided to adopt those existing elevator provisions. And the reason we did so is because we did notice a spike in accidents on escalators and elevators of varying types. So we implemented an existing elevator inspection program, and that was in 2007, and it gave owners of buildings 5 years to comply, and that wasn't in the national code. That was in our Minnesota rule, recognizing that there's three major components that are very expensive to upgrade, and one are elevator door restrictors to keep the elevator doors closed when that elevator may not end at a floor level so people don't step off into the shaft. The cylinders of hydraulic cylinders have a safety at the bottom of it, so they don't, right now, elevator hoistways that are hydraulic that were installed 40 years ago don't have this, and there is no safety if they fail due to corrosion. And the third item is firefighter service, which is where elevators return to a safe floor in the event that heat or smoke is detected on a certain level of the building. So we did give until January 29th, 2012, to bring elevator equipment into compliance. And, in fact, then in 2011, the legislature of Minnesota extended compliance by 3 years, so effectively bringing it up to January 29th, 2015, which effectively is nearly 9 years to comply with these three safety standards. The department believes that more than adequate time has been given. Most building owners, hundreds of them, have complied, and we do recognize that there are some in really tough financial straits that make this very difficult to satisfy. But we do believe the department has done our diligence and provided the responsibility necessary to try to get existing elevators upgraded in these key, crucial safety elements.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, if I have a question for Senator Cohen, if there are no more testifiers.
That's the end of the testifiers we have, so
okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Senator Cohen, I want to thank you for this thoughtful bill, because I was part of that 2011, that extension, and your testifier, Mr. Fricke, you did a wonderful job explaining the problem with retroactive things, and particularly on people who are living with fixed incomes, and kind of the maybe the exceptions that need to be made. And so rather than this extension that we could have done again, I really appreciate Senator Cohen's actual changing the language about where this would apply. And I'm hoping, Senator Cohen, that you would consider it a friendly amendment to move that to six floors. And, of course, I say that because I know of people just like Mr. Fricke in owner-occupied associations who have the very same issues.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, I've drafted this bill in accordance with the particular situation brought to my attention. I would leave it up to the committee if it's appropriate, if there are other kinds of situations. I would comment, though, Mr. Chairman, one of the things that Mr. McClellan said I did find a little bit bothersome, where he indicated, he spoke about the national code, and I've done a number of things around this place, but codes is not my area of expertise. So I'm not sure if that national code is by federal statute or, an association of engineers. But what I found particularly bothersome was his admittance that, yeah, there could be some situations where people are put into some type of financial duress. And that's exactly what we have here. Mm-hmm. And so, Senator Nelson, relative to your suggestion, I can't speak to it. You'd have more of a sense of what you're trying to prove. So I don't know that I oppose what you're doing at all.
So, okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
So I would offer just that amendment to strike having 5 to 6.
Okay. Senator Ross.
Meet several similar situations, exactly. Financial duress, owner-occupied, non-public elevator, all the good restrictions that you have in here.
Senator Ress.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the justifications offered by Mr. Fricke was that a five-story building does not require standpipes, and I was wondering if a six-story building does. If it also does not, I would feel differently about Senator Nelson's amendment, but until I'm assured of that, I would not support it because I think it would do damage to the justification for Senator Cohen's bill.
Mr. McClellan, do you know if six stories... Did you understand Senator Russ's concern?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator. I believe what Senator Cohen is referring to is the firefighter service. In fact, this may be the main issue in this particular building. It requires a certain controller that when you have an elevator that runs 25 feet or more above the floor of exit discharge, you're required to have this alternate system where the elevator will actually recall to a different floor. In the event of a fire, it won't bring you down to that fire floor. So it's 25 feet of travel. That's typically a 3 or 4 story building.
Okay. Any further discussion on Senator Nelson's oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
No. The motion prevails. Senator Cohen, to your bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we've had a chance to discuss this. I think we had a lengthier conversation last year on the floor. I think Mr. Fricke has offered some significant explanations as to why this was brought to my attention. Again, Mr. Chairman, I've indicated I'm not the expert in code compliance. What I do know something about, however, is the difficulty that oftentimes we place on folks who are in situations that things are simply unaffordable. And Mr. McClellan has made that very point himself. And I hope, Mr. Chairman, that you would consider passage of this bill for possible inclusion in whatever omnibus bill you're putting together.
Okay. Then Senator Rest will move that Senate File 803 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank
Chairman
you
members, much, thank Senator. You very much.
Thank you. Senator Tomasoni, Senate File 1764. Okay. Senator Tomasoni, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Senate File 1764, unlike many bills that come before your committee, cuts right to the bone.
Bad.
Send him off.
Next, next bill. Next bill. Next bill, Mr. Chair.
Next bill.
Nope. Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1764 is a correctional facility butcher training pilot program establishment, and the bill establishes a butcher training pilot program at the Northeastern Regional Correctional Center to train inmates for careers as butchers upon release. And I don't know if any of you have toured there when on bonding tours, but we call it NERC for short, is what they used to refer to as a work farm, and it's has a their low-level offenders are basically people who end up at this place, and they're oftentimes young people, and they have an incredibly low recidivism rate, and they do an absolutely great job of getting these kids back into society and working. And so what this bill does in attempting to develop this pilot program that has the Commissioner of Agriculture consulting with the Commissioner of Deed, the Northeast Regional Correction Centers, and the United Food and Commercial Workers. And it also requires a report to the legislative committees with jurisdiction over agriculture, higher education, and public safety on the progress and outcomes of this program by February 1, 2017. If you look at the map that is in your packet, I believe you have a map in your packet, you'll see that the red flags indicate existing USDA processing facilities, and as you can see, we're vegetarians in northeastern Minnesota because there are none up there. And and so this one, where the little green dot is on the flag or on the map, indicates where NERC is located, and that it would allow this to become a USDA processing facility also. But at the same time, it would train some of the inmates to become butchers, and it would and actually give them a job that right now there's a need for, and it appears that there's going to be a bigger need for in the very near future. And when they come out, they would actually be able to go to work and become functioning members of society. So, members, I'll turn this over to Kay Arla, who is the director of NERC, and she's here along with Bernie Hess.
Ms. Arla, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Senator Sparks. My name is Kay Arla. I'm the Executive Director of Arrowhead Regional Corrections. And Arrowhead Regional Corrections is a joint powers agency formed by the five counties that make up the Arrowhead region in Minnesota. Those counties include Lake County, Cook County, Couchiching County, Carleton County, and St. Louis County. We have been providing the correctional services to that region since 1976 under that joint powers agreement. That means we provide all of the probation services in the five counties. In addition, we own and operate a 48-bed juvenile detention facility called Arrowhead Juvenile Center. And last but not least, we own and operate the Northeast Regional Corrections Center, commonly known as NERC. NERC is a 150-bed correctional facility for adult males. It is located about 20 miles north of Duluth in Saginaw, Minnesota. It is situated on about 3,200 acres, and it is a working farm. It has actually been this blend of a correctional facility and a farm since the 1930s. So this is not a new concept, but it is certainly a unique concept, and one that we know works. Senator Tomasoni referenced our recidivism rates. We're very proud that this particular model sets men on the right path and they do not reoffend. About 83% of the men that come through our doors and serve their sentence there do not commit felonies in the 3 years from discharge. That is a much higher rate than state or national averages. So we are a traditional correctional facility. We have all of those programs. We have chemical dependency. We have education, mental health. But in addition, the men are assigned to work crews. And many of the work crews then support the farm operation. So the farm operation, what do we do? Last year, we grew hay on about 400 acres. We had vegetables on another 40 acres. We grow all kinds of vegetables, corn, potatoes, carrots, onions. We produce about 75,000 pounds of produce last year. That's an average year. In addition, though, we raise chickens, turkeys, and pigs. And we, as a result of that, we have a processing facility on grounds. That has been there a number of years, and the handout in your packet is actually being used because we are looking to replace that processing plant. It is beyond life expectancy. There are safety issues and code issues, and we need to demolish the existing building and rebuild the plant. That really was the springboard for the bill that you see before you. It open the door to looking at what are some other opportunities. Right now, the processing building is where we process our own chickens, turkeys, and pigs. We do serve some of the local customers in the area, but we are only certified to process meat for your personal consumption. We work with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and we have a licensed meat cutter on staff. That meat cutter takes 7 to 12 men every day out to the processing plant. And at this time, he's able to work with them on what I would call more soft job skills. So things like, you know, get to work on time, listen to your boss, get along with coworkers, take some pride in your work. In addition, he's teaching them some of the skills of meat cutting, but it is not a certified program at this point. And this could be an opportunity for us to really move that to the next level and look at it as a vocational track to allow these men to transition out into the community with a skill that will lead to a job. That is a prime tenet of corrections. The correlation between employment and recidivism is clear in our work. And so we think this is an opportunity to really look at that. In addition, as Senator Tomassoni pointed out, we have a whole region that is not able to process their livestock without transporting it hundreds of miles. I'm told that's very cost prohibitive, and so many of them don't make the effort. It's not worth it for them. And so they are losing an opportunity as small farmers to turn that around and be able to sell that in either restaurants or local grocery stores. And lastly, I would just point out that there is certainly a trend in our society towards more healthy eating, and people are very interested in locally sourced meats and vegetables. And if we do this pilot project and we get your support, it really seems to me that this could be a win-win-win on all those levels. So I ask your support for this bill.
Thank you, Executive Director. Any questions for Senator Dames?
Yes, so Senator Tomassoni or Ms. Areola, could you tell me what the cost of the state is going to be for this bill?
Our bond request at this point to rebuild, we're requesting $1.2 million.
Follow up, and Mr. Chairman,
I don't believe that's the cost of this bill, though.
Oh,
I think that.
Oh, this. No, I thought you said building. That's the cost of rebuilding.
Right.
No, I don't.
Senator Thomas.
I think this is might have a cost in the future, but immediately in this particular budget cycle, I don't believe there's a cost in this particular budget cycle.
Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomassoni, I think this is really a good bill. I think this is a good idea. But I would like to have an oral amendment, and that would be on page 1 that we strike line 15. I think that this pilot program can be set up without bringing in the United Food and Commercial Workers. I think this can be set up as a pilot program without that, so I'd like to strike that language.
Okay. Before we do that, can we hear from Mr. Hess? Then we can still take action. Is that fair? Okay. Mr. Hess, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bernie Hess. I'm a member of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 1189. We're a union that represents workers in retail, food processing, long-term care. We have a number of meatpacking plants, and our recent addition is now the medical cannabis industry. We support Senate File 1764. We'd like to thank the senator for bringing this forward. We support the pilot project. We offer assistance in putting together a training curriculum along with a number of other resources we could bring about setting up the program. What is being proposed isn't new. My president, Don Sequist, used to teach inmates meat cutting skills up at the St. Cloud Reformatory. He reminded me that you always count the knives after class twice. If we had put this curriculum together, what we would do, there are a number of things that you that workers would need to learn in order to be successful at this. Concentration, you have to know how to avoid injuries and how not to waste product.
There's customer service skills, manual dexterity is very important. You have to have good hand control, physical stamina. You spend long hours on your feet cutting, packaging, and storing meat. Physical strength, often in a retail setting, meat still does come in swinging or in a large boxes. There is a need for training. As our workforce grows older and older, we have to figure out a way to train workers. Obviously, this is one option. We'd also like to see more vocational training, but to be quite blunt, there are no schools right now that have this in their curriculum. There's a number of culinary arts programs, but there's no longer a meat cutting program. There's only about five real meat cutting programs left in the U.S. It was alluded to about the local food movement. I think this is a great opportunity for folks to get plugged in up in this region on that. And I think this would be a really good piece of legislation to help ex-offenders get back into the job market. So thank you.
Okay.
And
Senator Thomason.
So, Mr. Chairman, to Senator Deems' amendment, I would hope we would just leave the United Food and Commercial Workers in the bill, because I think this is just for having a representative there that can give advice on how this should proceed, and they have a lot of members who do this kind of work, and so I think it's a good thing to have in the bill, to have somebody who can actually give good advice on this type of thing.
Okay, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sounds like something that might be in Senator Bonoff's pipelines project.
Yeah.
But what I'm wondering about is, are there other inmate training career programs at this facility, at the Northeast Regional Correction Center?
Executive Director, and then we better get back to the amendment, but I'll allow this question.
Oh, because it should follow.
Okay.
It should follow the same procedures.
Senator, we employ a vocational counselor who works with the individual men, but there, I wouldn't say there's a vocational track that would be as formal as what we are looking at in this pilot.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, so my thought was that, however, this training program should be structured in a similar way to how other training programs are offered in our other facilities, in our other corrections facilities. That was the point of my question. And I don't know how those are structured in our other correctional facilities. And I don't know. And so that's how I think this bill should be structured, which leads me to think that it might not. Perhaps the amendment is in order, which is that we would strike United Food and Commercial Workers unless we have similar situations in other correction facilities where we literally say legislatively that a particular union or other program should be part of that. Does anybody know the answer to other correctional facilities training programs?
I don't see anyone coming forward, Senator Nelson. Anyway, Senator Deems.
Mr. Chair, and I think Mr. Fuller or
boy, Mr. Knopf, I'm sorry,
has some language the way he feels we should have that.
Mr. Chair, if you're going to delete that line, you have to do a little more than that. So on line 1.13, delete of each and delete everything after the. So you're deleting following organizations, colon. Delete everything before Northeast on 1.14. Mm-hmm. Delete everything after center and insert a period on 1.14. And delete line 1.15. So it'll read with the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development and a representative of the Northeast Regional Corrections Center, period.
Okay. Members clear on that?
I have a question, Mr.
Senator Nelson.
So that would not, if this amendment passed, it would not necessarily rule out working with United Food and Commercial Workers. It would just not require it. Is that correct? Would not rule it out, would just not require.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, yes. This just ties into the must consult. It doesn't say who they can't consult with.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Thomason, any final comments?
Mr. Chairman, I think I'd like to leave the bill the way it is. It seems to me that if you have people in the know, developing the program, that that's what you want to do. And I think this doesn't preclude putting more people on a commission, but I think it at least has some people who have some experience on here, and I think we'd like to see that.
Okay. On the Dames Oral Amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say no.
No.
No. The oral amendment is not adopted. Senator Tomasoni.
So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I guess I need a motion to move the bill.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 1764 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you.
Senator Jensen, Senate File 1767. Senator Jensen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here to present Senate File 1767. It calls for the repeal of a subdivision of a Minnesota rule related to the operation of a manual rope pole man lift in a Minnesota grain elevator or feed mill. The current Minnesota rule requires two suspension cables, if not less than 1/2 inch in diameter, for a manual rope pull lift. I believe we are the only state that has a specific regulation for a manual rope pull man lift, which is far too specific, off base from some of the requirements and setting up many grain elevators and feed mills to fail, with Minnesota OSHA stepping up its enforcement of the rule recently. The rule has been around for several years, but until recently, it was used as a suggested guide and not as an enforcement tool. Now Minnesota OSHA is using the rule as a checklist, creating a very real problem for hundreds of grain elevators and feed mills throughout the state. I do have with me Bob Zelenka from the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association that would like to talk to the bill.
Mr. Chairman, can I just ask just a question?
Sure, Senator Ross.
Are the photos here from Senator Jensen or from the opposition?
I believe these are from Senator Jensen, but yes. Sorry, but thank you. We should have that on there. Mr. Zelenka, if you'd like to make some brief comments, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, there is a handout in your materials with the grain elevator on the front, if you've noticed, I'll go through that in a minute. Just like to preface that with the fact that the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association represents grain elevators and feed mills in the state of Minnesota. Have been in existence for 108 years. In looking at this particular requirement, we feel that this is a totally unnecessary Minnesota or portion of a Minnesota rule. Cost estimates that we've looked at, when you look at the cost of having to add a second suspension cable, is a close to a $20 million impact on our industry. That's looking at $100,000 to $150,000 per man lift to add that second suspension cable. Even if you can get the second suspension cable in there, it just is leading elevators to simply probably close their facilities as a result, in some cases, eliminating jobs, taxes, forcing farmers to travel longer distances to get to sell their grain and to purchase their inputs. The vast majority of manual roll-pull man lifts, which has its origins back in the Roman times, I might add, were designed and installed using only one suspension cable. They performed as intended without any known safety problems for many, many years. This exceptionally high cost, and as the Senator mentioned, with OSHA now recently using the Minnesota rule essentially as a checklist, has created a real stir in our industry. When you look at the cost of having to add that second cable at the $100,000 and $150,000 level, we have some additional supporters from the Cooperative Network, Agri-Growth Council, and we also have the Minnesota Ag Cooperative Safety Directors Association, which are the safety professionals that provide safety training and education at our member facilities around the state of Minnesota. I mentioned the handout which you have in front of you. If I could walk through that briefly, on the front of the cover is the series of facilities in Thief River Falls, just for your information, give you an idea of the facilities we're talking about here, grain elevators. On the first page, you can see the basic elements of a man lift. You have a rope, you have a cable, and you have a counterweight. On the next page, if you look at the ground floor entrance, you can see the man lift, very small as it is, and you're just essentially pulling yourself up with a counterweight pulling down on the opposite direction. On the next page where it has the foot brake, you'll notice that is a safety feature in all manual roll pull man lifts. To disengage the brake, you push the pedal down, and then that allows the lift to go up and or down. On the next page, which is the critical page, is the page that has the cable attachment to car, a cable shiv, a top rope attachment. You see that language on that page. What you can see there is this is a single cable going through the shiv and then attached to the counterweight. You'll notice in the upper left corner picture where it says cable attachment to car, you'll see the cable going through the top of the man lift attached, so very, very clearly, very well attached. You'll notice that there's some springs there in that photo. What happens is if the cable would happen to break for any reason, that spring would then essentially kick out two locks, emergency locks, that would immediately lock the lift from any free fall. But you also notice that if you're talking about trying to put in a second cable and shiv and counterweight in this type of arrangement with the small space you're looking at, it's nearly impossible to do. I might also add that the cable you're looking at in this photo looks in pretty good shape. This cable was put in 1951. The man lifts are used primarily for maintenance on the second and third floor of the grain elevators. Were required by grain handling standard, national standard, to provide preventive maintenance, housekeeping, and those kind of activities. So the man lift is critical for those types of activities in our facilities. The last page just shows you the man lift at the top and looking down the lift. If, in fact, an elevator was forced to not utilize that manual roll pull man lift because of the being out of compliance with the Minnesota rule, particularly in this case with the two suspension cable requirement, the people servicing the elevator would essentially have to, if you want to return to that first page where the picture of the grain elevator is located, they'd have to crawl up the outside of the grain elevator down over the top of the elevator storage bins into the main house to do any maintenance work and then back down again. That certainly doesn't improve safety. In fact, it compromises safety by that being forced to do that. So long story short, we feel that the requirement for a second suspension cable is totally unnecessary, adds an extreme amount of cost to the operation if, in fact, we're required to put that second cable into these manual roll pull man lifts. We're looking at approximately 150 grain elevators around the state of Minnesota that currently have and utilize a manual roll pull man lift, so you're looking at a substantial cost statewide to our industry. So I thank the senator for bringing this forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zelenka. Any question for the witness? If not, I believe Mr. Kruger from the Minnesota Department of OSHA would like to, been a long afternoon, make a statement. Mr. Kruger, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Jim Kruger. I'm the Minnesota OSHA Enforcement Director. MinOSHA adopted this rule in 1979. In the last 10 years, Minnesota OSHA has conducted 207 inspections in the grain industry. MinOSHA has cited this particular Minnesota rule, 5205-058-800, subpart 21, five times. In one of those inspections, an employer had an accident involving a hand-powered man lift. As the employee entered and did not set the brake, the hand-powered man lift safety latches failed. The employee fell 60 feet, resulting in leg, chest, and back injuries to the employee. In this case, if the primary rope/cable fails, there's no secondary backup to hold the powered man lift in place. Hand-powered man lifts are very similar to suspended scaffolds. Instead of being outside in the construction industry and window washing, they are inside, primarily used in grain facilities. If a suspended scaffold primary line fails, the construction worker or window washer has a secondary rope/cable to prevent them from falling. MinOSHA believes that a hand-powered man lift should have a secondary cable to hold it in place if the primary one fails. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Kruger, for your testimony.
Any questions for the witnesses or the author? Anyone else want to be heard on Senate File 1767? If not, Senator Coonan moves that Senate File 1776 be recommended to pass. 1767. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you. Senator Coonan, Senate File 1271. Senator Coonan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I do have an A1 amendment.
Okay, an A1 and author's amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor of the A1 author's amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Coonan, to your bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 1271 instructs the Commissioner of Agriculture to study the growth or decline of animal agriculture in Minnesota and the surrounding states over the last 10 years. It further instructs the Commissioner to identify the causes of that growth or decline. And MDA has stated that they understand the need for this type of study and they believe they could do this work. And then in addition, my amendment asks the department to include in the report the number of livestock farms in each state during that same time. And, Mr. Chairman, this is the policy committee. There is a fiscal note here, but that does not include the adding of the study of the number of farms. I don't know if this will change that now. I don't think it would change it much, but just to bring that to note, and I know that's more of a that's something we don't necessarily take care of in a policy committee, but I just wanted to note that. And that's the bill.
All right. Well, thank you, Senator Coonan. Are there any questions or comments among committee members? Anybody in the audience would like to speak to the bill at this stage? All right, seeing none, Senator Coonan, would you like to make a motion on the bill?
This bill.
Did we adopt the amendment?
I'm not sure. Does it go to finance? Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move that Senate File 1271 pass and be referred to finance.
Senator Coonan moves that Senate File 1271 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor, aye.
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 Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. All right, up next we have Senator Sparks. Thank you, Senator Coonan. We have Senator Sparks with Senate File 1822.
Mr. Chairman, if it's okay with you, I'd like to do Senate File 1371 first, please.
That's no problem. So we'll look at Senate File 1371.
And members will remember, this is the Department of Labor and Industry Policy Omnibus Bill. And at this time, I'd like to offer the A2 Delete All Everything Amendment. And what that does, members, is it includes language from the three Department of Labor and Industry Policy Bills that were heard and amended on committee on March 19th. Senate File 1371, which is a bill that I offered on construction codes. Senate File 1381 was a bill that Senator Schmidt heard on combative sports. And Senate File 1462 was Senator Eakin's bill dealing with OSHA. And if we can adopt that, then I would also have an oral amendment that I need to make to get the bill in the shape I would like. This bill did pass off the floor, two bills without the Eakin provisions, 50-4 last year, just for members' records. And we haven't made any changes to it.
All right. Well, thank you, Senator Sparks. Would you like to make an oral amendment to the amendment you're offering?
Should we do that now, or do you want to?
Can we do either way.
Okay. I believe it is the oral amendment would be on line 14.7, strike 6222110.
And insert.
Senator Sparks, if I could interrupt, I believe we're looking to make an oral amendment on line 14.17. Is okay. that correct?
Yep, that is correct.
Right, just to clarify.
Yep.
Please proceed.
And then insert 62210. Merely technical, and council can help me out if that's not correct.
All right. Thank you, Senator Sparks. Perhaps council could restate the oral amendment.
Page 14, line 7622110 and 622210. So we're talking one of the ones.
All right. Members, at this stage.
Senator.
Yes, Senator Rust.
I can just include that as a modification of the delete all rather than having to have a separate vote.
That's my understanding. So if there's no further discussion on the amendments, this is a, I guess it's not an author's amendment necessarily at this stage. So all those in favor of the amendment, aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. All right, Senator Sparks, if you'd like to proceed.
Then I think, members should know what's inside the bill. We've all voted on all three provisions. There have been no changes. So I don't know, unless members have questions, I would just move that bill. It would go to the Senate floor.
All right. Well, Senator Sparks moves that the bill, Senate file 1371, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. All those in favor, aye.
Aye. Aye.
And those opposed, no. Motion prevails. All right, Senator Sparks, if we'd like to redirect our attention now to Senate file 1822.
Okay, members, this Senate file 1822 is the Work Comp Advisory Council bill. I believe that members should have an amendment to the A15 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like.
All right, staff is providing us with the amendment. All right, Senator Sparks. All right, well, we're just waiting for the amendment to make its way out. And Senator Sparks would like to move the A15 author's amendment. All right. And I don't think we need to vote on that. So all those.
I'm sorry.
The A15-260 author's amendment. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. And the motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. If you'd like to move forward.
Mr. Chair and members, I just want to turn it over to the Assistant Commissioner to explain what's in the bill, and then we can hear from other witnesses in the interest of time.
Very well. Sir, if you don't mind stating your name for the record and proceeding.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Chris Liefeld. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of the Workers' Compensation Division with the Department of Labor and Industry. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the bill today, Senate File 1822. This proposed legislation was approved by the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council last week at its March 11, 2015 meeting. The bill itself is divided into two sections. The first section addresses the issue of electronic billing and payment transactions between providers and payers. Minnesota Statute 62J536 mandates electronic transactions for all payers and providers in Minnesota. But there are particular challenging issues and barriers that are unique to the workers' compensation system, and those barriers are addressed by this bill. First, the first approach or issue or approach used in addressing those issues is C on the bill on the first page, which addresses the requirement or mandates the requirement to have information placed on the payer's website. Some very specific information, name of the payer's clearinghouse, payer ID, and a number of other items that are listed under C. The legislation does, again, require that to be placed on the payer's website in a prominent location or otherwise provide the information to the healthcare providers. Under D, the language addresses the issue of electronic attachment and puts in place an electronic attachment standard that would be used both for the payer and the provider.
And this will make it a much more efficient and user-friendly process for both the payer and the provider. The third piece of Section 1 relates to the issue that providers have had matching payments to the bills. And so when they receive the payments, oftentimes the payment may be sent separately from the electronic explanation of bill benefits or in one bulk check or in some other manner. So what we try to do here is that the language requires information to be provided that is sufficient to allow providers to match payments to specific bills. And then so it require this patient's name, patient account number to accompany all payments. And if payment is for more than one patient, the check or EFT statement must specify the amount being paid for each payment. And finally, the last piece is there is penalty authority on the part of the commissioner if the payer providers are not following what's called in statute. Section 2 relates to the electronic fund transfer of injured workers to get paid by the payers. Current rule states that the injured worker can request and is of the payer to provide direct deposit or direction of their monetary benefit payments to a bank or financial institution. But it's older language, so there is not language related to electronic fund transfer, anything related to electronic, nor is there a penalty authority in that. So what this part, this section of the bill does is puts in place the requirement that if the injured worker requests to have electronic fund transfer of their monetary benefits, it would be required on the part of the payer to do so. Now, it does give room for 30 days if there is not a relationship already between the payer and the injured worker for this electronic payments. It gives 30 days for that to be established. And actually, it's 30 days just to establish it. And if there is not that relationship, there's an additional 14 days for that to be created. So it's ultimately would be a total of 44 days in that case. And currently the way the language is drafted is that that it would go into law on the day after enactment. And there is a penalty provision on that also.
All right. Well, thank you, sir. Any questions at this stage?
I will have questions, but I'd rather wait till all the testifiers have testified.
Very well. Sir Sparks, would you like to bring up your other testifiers?
I can, and maybe, Mr. Chair, if I make one more small change, we might be able to address some what I believe could be Senator Dames' concerns and perhaps the other folks.
Sure,
I
Senator
believe
Sparks.
And Mr. Fuller can help me. On the last page, line 4.24, for an effective date, we would like to have that read October 1st. Mr. Fuller can help me. The effective date would be October 1st.
Mr. Fuller, if you'd mind.
Mr. Chair, page 4, line 24, delete the day following final enactment and insert October 1st, 2015. It would read this section is effective October 1st, 2015.
All right. Senator Sparks moves the oral amendment as just recited by Mr. Fuller. Any questions? All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
That's the end of my testifier. So I don't know if Senator Dames wants to talk or if other people would like to come forward. They're
okay.
Certainly welcome.
We have a couple of names on our list here today. If you'd like to testify, please approach the testifiers table at this stage. Welcome to the committee, if you don't mind stating your name for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Shep Harris here on behalf of the Minnesota Self-Insured Group, which is a private sector self-insured coalition of organizations which work with thousands of Minnesotans from the healthcare industry to the construction industry and everything in between. I first want to thank the chief author for throwing in and the members of the committee for doing that quick oral amendment on the effective date change. I'm here today not to oppose the bill, but express some concerns, and we just want to go on the record saying that so that we can continue the work with the author and with the department and with other stakeholders as the bill moves through the process. And we just wanted to let members know that in a couple of particular cases, what we're hoping is that, unfortunately, we just saw the language 2 days ago when it was introduced. Yes, it was discussed at the Workers' Comp Advisory Council, but the language was not in front of the parties or the observers there, so we did not have an opportunity to weigh in on it. So we just wanted members to know that there are some mandates in the bill that we hope can get worked out that we're not sure if they're attainable, especially immediately. And so that's why we appreciate the push out. We think that's a step in the right direction. It's possible, hopefully, in discussions, we may need actually as long as a year on the implementation of this, but at least we feel like the 6 months is a good start. The challenge will be creating a system for some organizations to offer both systems, the EFT system as well as the cash transactions, because we've actually found out, believe it or not, there are some claimants out there who don't have bank accounts. So, you know, in this day and age, you think that wouldn't be existent, but it is the case. And so we just need to make sure that we have that time to set up those systems and evaluate the language and make sure that this is done efficiently and effectively. And not haphazardly. So, again, I just wanted to say thank you for your time, and we look forward to working with the various stakeholders and with the chief author as this bill moves through the process.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. If you don't mind, sir, Mr. Cordes, if you'd like to state your name for the record.
Yes, Evan Cordes. I'm with the Minnesota Counties Intergovernmental Trust. We are a government entity that represents 81 of the 87 counties. We are the self-insured risk pool for those counties, along with 350 other government entities, including your county fairs, your collaboratives, your task forces, and any other sort of government you can see tied to a county. We represent them. We have several concerns, and we do appreciate the extra time here. We do worry that there is not enough time to study and to budget properly because there are significant potential budget ramifications. And I just want to present a couple of our concerns. Public entities are often lost in the discussion of work comp changes. And as a fully taxpayer-funded entity, this is going to require extra time, upgrades to our computer software, possibly extra staff, as well as working out government accountability standards with both the state and federal auditors that we're going to need time and possibly a study that's paid for with taxpayer money to determine the feasibility and the extent. So we hope we can work with the chief author, with labor, and with the chamber to come to some conclusion that works well for all of our groups and ultimately gets employees their wages in an efficient and effective manner.
Well, thank you, Mr. Cordes. Senator Bonoff, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sparks, I'm concerned about the penalty section. I get concerned when I hear that we're going to make a change and then assess what looks like pretty significant penalties. That one in the one section says up to $25,000, which, especially for a small company, they're not complying. Sometimes there's a reason why they're not complying. They may not have the ability to comply. And so I'm wondering if you could address that.
I'm going to need to bring the assistant commissioner back to help me with that one.
Very well. And, sir, if you don't mind restating your name for the record.
Sure, absolutely. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chris Liefeld, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Labor and Industry. Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, what was your question? It was related to the penalty aspect of it?
Yes, Mr. Deputy Commissioner. I am concerned about the fee, the penalties.
And I think what we're our attempt there is, I guess, in both sections, is to look for a way to motivate the payers and providers, I guess, in related to the first section, to abide by the law. It's a may, you know, we may penalize, so I think it gives us a certain flexibility in working with the payers and providers in terms of penalizing them. But we're just trying to figure out a way, because there's been a challenge for the different parties as part of electronic transaction to do it. And so that's, as an agency, we thought, well, is there a way to motivate them to push them along to abide by what the legislation called for back in 2009.
Yep.
So that's why we did put it in.
Senator Bonner.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chair. I just find usually when people don't do something, there's a barrier or an obstacle. And so I agree, if you put a tough enough penalty, they'll find a way through the barrier obstacle. But I'm just wondering if there isn't a more proactive partnering way to help get rid of the obstacle or the barrier.
Sir,
if you don't mind stating your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Benjamin Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. So I was involved in a lot of these negotiations, and I know the deputy commissioner was as well. I think that the main barrier that we saw is as hospitals, so providers and payers, were engaged in electronic transactions, the problem was mostly with their clearinghouses. The issue is the commissioner doesn't have authority, statutory authority, over those clearinghouses. And so the frustration was you would have a hospital send a bill to an insurer, and then the hospital's clearinghouse wouldn't talk to the insurer's clearinghouse, and it would get sent as a hard copy or paper. And the same thing would happen in the reverse. The insurer would respond through their electronics transmission, and their clearinghouse wouldn't talk to the hospital's clearinghouse, and then all that information would get transferred. So we're hoping that this will clear that up. It's actually going to save everyone a lot of money because everybody has to pay when those things happen, including the insurers and the providers, and it also slows down the process. I think that's really important. I understand, so that answers your
Thank
question.
Thank you. Yeah, it does. That's helpful. Thank you.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is for Mr. Liefeld, however that's pronounced. I apologize if I got it wrong. It's my understanding that when we work with workers' compensation legislation, that typically it's been a precedent that goes through the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. And so I do have a concern, as I understand talking to stakeholders, that Section 1 of this bill was discussed at the Work Comp Advisory Council, and the stakeholders had an opportunity to weigh in on that, and that the Section 1 was an agreement with all the parties. But that I understand Section 2 was not discussed at the Workers' Compensation or with the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. And it seems to be that's the section where I am hearing a lot of issues from stakeholders. I'm just curious why that was not discussed with Workers' Compensation Advisory Council when we set precedent that that's how we make decisions.
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the first section of the bill, the language, specifically the language, was in front of the members of the Advisory Council, and they did vote on that language with a few minor amendments so changes were made in that language. The second section of the bill was actually discussed by the Advisory Council. It was offered as a proposal by one of the members of the Advisory Council. And ultimately, the Advisory Council took a vote on moving forward with electronic funds transfer. They did not vote specifically on the language that itself. That's true, because we did not have language. But the department was directed to go ahead and draft language for the legislation. So that's what we did as an agency, is we drafted the legislation.
Senator Dames.
That's quite concerning that you tell me that, well, they did vote on this and that they did approve it, but that they didn't have the language. I it's kind of hard to vote on something and approve it when you don't have the language, and this bill it throws 316, 2015 in the bill, so obviously it didn't have the language, and we're getting a lot. I understand there's a lot of stakeholders that have some real heartburn with part of this. I was thinking about just doing an amendment to just eliminate Section 2, but I don't think that that's the thing to do. But I do think we need to proceed with caution, and I think we need to have a precedent. If we're not going to use the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council on a regular basis, then that's fine. But if we're going to, then all legislation and all statute changes needs to go through that organization, and we're clearly not doing that. So I do have concern about that. But instead of making an amendment, I just want to make sure that you folks are going to be willing to work with the stakeholders, because there is some real angst in Section 2. There's some complications, there's some problems, and we can't just gloss those over. And it kind of appears that's what the department is trying to do right now, and I don't really like that. So I would just ask that we make sure that you folks work very closely with the stakeholders and we get these issues taken care of so that February 1st we have something that the stakeholders can agree with and work on.
And members, I should just remind you, there is a rules committee that's scheduled for 4 o'clock here today, so we are running up against that. But I know
Senator Dames, I understand your points. I think they're very well taken, and we won't move forward with anything else. In fact, I think Knopf, or Mr. Knopf has to help me take some rulemaking authority out of this bill to keep it moving. If you can help me do that quickly, then we can proceed. But we won't move forward with anything else. But I understand what you're saying, Senator Dames.
All right. Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just be very brief. And Senator Sparks, you may have already or are in the process of addressing the question I had. I'd like to know how the language regarding electronic funds transfers in this bill in Section 2 differs from the language that the Workers' Comp Council voted to approve. What are the differences between what the Workers' Comp Council was voted on favorably and the bill in front of us?
Sir, if you could state your name for the record.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Brad Leto, Chief of Staff with Minnesota AFL-CIO, alternate on the council, but the president was there at the council, Sher Knudsen. If you're talking about the, I'm not sure if you're talking one Section 1 or Section 2.
Mr. Chair, Section 2. I'm specifically talking about Section 2.
Section 2 was offered, there was discussion, when the Section 1 was being discussed on the bill, one of the employee representatives brought up the issue, asked if there was any kind of current rule or anything on electronic transfer. There's a very old rule which the council for the department, it mentions there's a very old rule, but it doesn't actually even talk about electronic transfer. It basically is like, you know, it could be like transferring a check. The check actually is sent to another bank. So the question was, well, should we update the rule? Should we add statutory language? And they discussed it. They said there was a motion made to add language to the bill and was seconded by the employer community, and it passed unanimously. And then directed the department to come up with language. Now, it is true that, yes, we haven't seen the language, and I completely agree to work with the parties to try and come up with language that works, and which is why I actually mentioned going to October 1st, because benefits generally are effective October 1st. If that doesn't work, we can talk about it, but, I mean, that was why we went to October 1st, or I suggest going to October 1st for an effective date. Commit entirely working with the chamber and the parties that have problems with this to try and work it out. But yes, the language was not considered there because and that's not the only time that's ever happened at the advisor council over the years, that people have suggested stuff and then language has been developed from that.
Senator Nelson.
I feel comfortable with Senator Sparks' commitment to make sure that all of the parties actually do get to weigh in on this language that's before us. And then where would this bill go next after it leaves this committee?
Senator Sparks.
To the floor, I believe, if you take the rulemaking out. But, yeah, you have my promise on that, Senator Nelson. I'm not going to bring anything forward unless everyone's in agreement.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Fuller.
And Mr. Fuller, if you don't mind sharing the amendment that we're proposing.
Mr. Chair, members, on page 2, line 34, delete clause F, so line 34, 35, 3-1, 3-2. On 3-3, delete G, insert F. On 3-4, delete everything after section up to the, and including the comma. So it would say the commissioner may assess a monetary penalty of $500 for each violation of this section, not to exceed $25,000. So the reference to the paragraph F is deleted because we're deleting paragraph F.
So Senator Sparks moves the amendment that Mr. Fuller just shared with us without any questions or comments. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment passes. The motion prevails.
And Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 1822 as amended be recommended to pass.
All right. Senator Sparks has moved the bill. Any questions, concerns? All those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Bill is passed to the floor. And that concludes our business for today. Thank you, members.